Well, hi everyone, and welcome to today's CBI at 10. My name is Liz Mosley, I'm an editor at Tortoise, and as ever, I'm here to host this morning's conversation. We are going to start in a second with Ray Newton-Smith, Chief Economist at CBI, and talking briefly about the impact of the war in Ukraine and the impact on CBI members and their businesses of the obviously the sanctions package that has been put against Putin to try and help de-escalate that situation and the likely future impact on business operations in this country, energy prices, supply chains, oil and gas sectors and all of that. It's obviously quite a big topic. We're not expecting to offer any simple or obvious solutions, but we're just trying to play back what the role of the CBI is and how this very live and distressing situation is evolving to try and give those of you whose businesses are directly impacted already a bit of a sense of how the CBI can help and support. Although it is a slightly uncomfortable, we've just said it's a slight handbrake turn, uncomfortable segue. We are also going to have a conversation today about growth and to imagine for a moment that life will go on as normal and to talk a bit about forthcoming budget announcements and statements and so on and what that means for the Go for Growth agenda that the CBI is pursuing and what that means for us all. Rain, hard to know where to start. Everybody's been following the invasion of Ukraine. It will continue to dominate the headlines as indeed it should. Just give us a sense of what the CBI has been doing in response and what some of the business implications are already, even this early into the conflict.
Absolutely, Liz. And of course, first and foremost, our thoughts are absolutely with all those civilians and families affected by the war in Ukraine. And it's just sort of devastating almost to watch the devastation sort of unfolding in front of our eyes. And I don't think we ever really thought we'd end up at the situation with a war on Europe's borders again. I think as in so many cases, we've been really trying to step up and understand how businesses can help, the role we play in implementing the sanctions effectively, the tools that Western countries are using at the moment is around an economic war. How can we use non-military means through sanctions to really limit the invasion of Ukraine and targeting those at Russia? Our president, Lord Bilimoria, met with some of our business leaders and the Ukrainian ambassador to speak directly about how businesses could help. And we had a very emotional, actually, all staff yesterday where, of course, and I'm sure this is true for so many businesses, where many of our staff who are Ukrainian are obviously hugely concerned about their families in Ukraine and just sharing some of the experiences that they are going through. And that is true for so many businesses who also have operations right throughout the region. And I think, look, there's no doubt it will have an impact on our economy, but I think what everyone is clear is, we have to take our safety and security really seriously. And I think the things that we've sort of taken for granted around freedom, suddenly feel so much more precarious. And it really, I think, speaks to why, we need to be engaged in international diplomacy, how, countries do need to work together. And hopefully we can build on some of the work that, we did last year as part of the G7 to really ensure that we have a united front in how we tackle the conflict. And of course, we're working very closely with the FCDO, with the DIT, the Department of International Trade. And really, I think our role is trying to gather feedback from members, what they are experiencing on the ground, and how we implement those sanctions effectively, and the sort of questions that businesses might have. So I think if we think about it, it's first and foremost, we're helping support our members who have staff in the regions and friends and relatives caught up in the conflict and indeed on both sides, because this will have an impact on Russian civilians as well, though obviously primarily the impact we're seeing, the humanitarian crisis, is absolutely with the Ukrainians at the moment. So how can we help people caught up in the conflict and the refugees as well? And also providing a channel on how businesses can help with humanitarian efforts. I think it's been Heartening to see how businesses have been willing to step forward with donations in kind. I think the Ukrainian ambassador understandably was very clear that at the moment what they need right now is resources. Having goods in kind that are stuck in the UK when they have a huge logistical operation of being able to provide food and shelter to refugees both on the border of Ukraine and in Ukraine itself. So we will provide information. The Red Cross obviously are doing a huge amount of work in the UN, etc., around what are the official organizations where businesses who want to help can really channel their efforts. And also on some of the logistics, businesses have made offers of help. And if anyone is interested in joining those efforts, then do reach out to us. We're also encouraging businesses to get in touch with us around the challenges they're facing with insights at cbi.org.uk. That's an open source inbox where we can take queries. And on our website, we also have a sort of holding page where people can go to if they want more information on the sanctions and how they can implement them, and to be signposted to more information from the Department for International Trade, and particularly around financial sanctions. We're working closely with UK Finance and others to help implement that. And I think more broadly, and it's still early days in this part, but thinking about how we help refugees and asylum seekers when they arrive in the UK, there's obviously a role for business there in creating opportunities. And whether it's been in the conflict in Afghanistan or Syria and now in the Ukraine, I think what's really important is when people are here, they have the right to work, to be able to support themselves. And that right for asylum seekers to work is something that we've advocated for at the CBI. So really, I think on that whole humanitarian effort, we're here to listen. I think we're here to implement the economic sanctions effectively. I think what we do know in terms of the impact on the UK and the world economy is obviously the direct impact that we're seeing at the moment is on oil and commodity prices. I think we've all learned over the past few days just how important Russia and the Ukraine are to so many things. Of course, Russia supplies almost 40% of Europe's natural gas. For the UK, we have less exposure. It's about 5%. But I think actually there's a lot of commodities that we don't think about in terms of nickel, copper, palladium, and the Ukraine is known as Europe's breadbasket, a huge producer of wheat and many other commodities. So I think businesses are only just starting to understand the implications on supply chains. And of course, higher oil and commodity prices in the UK context, feeding in here to more of a squeeze in our standard of living. It was a big challenge going into this conflict, and I think we'll see more and more pressures, though, hopefully some of that will be relatively short-lived. And of course, we're all on sort of tenterhooks to see where this conflict ends up. So I think that hopefully gives an overview of some of the efforts we are doing to support the humanitarian efforts, what we can do around sanctions, and then thinking a bit around the impact on the UK and global outlook. But I think us as businesses, our role is to do what we can to support the humanitarian efforts, but also, focus on how we can keep our businesses going. And in the UK, it can feel difficult for us to focus on that. But it's focusing on where we have agency and what we can do to help the efforts here, but also more globally. So we've got, a world of opportunities that we can come back to when hopefully this conflict comes to an end.
Thanks ever so much, Rain. I can see in the chat that the resources that Rain has mentioned there have been posted, links to the CBI resource page, that open source email inbox that Rain mentioned. So pick those up. And if you do have specific questions that our panel this morning can help with, then please do ask them. One has come in from Linda Hasmanis. Does the CBI have any information about the humanitarian sponsorship opportunity that was announced yesterday? It might be a bit soon for us to know how that works.
Yeah, I don't. We haven't got. I haven't got details to hand on how that will operate. But I think you'll have seen that a couple of things. We do have a note on our website on the economic impact. If people want more detail on that, we've got information on sanctions and how to find more information on that. And we are also gathering insights and offers of help from organisations who want to help with the humanitarian efforts, and we're coordinating that as well through the Ukrainian embassy, so we can put more details on that, or do reach out to that inbox if you have specific offers of help that we can help channel to where it's most effective.
All right, that's brilliant. Thanks ever so much, Rain. I am going to talk about growth in a second, but just before I do, Giles Wilkes is here, Senior Fellow at the Institute for Government. Hi, Giles. Thanks for being here. Just before we move on from Russia-Ukraine, sanctions obviously have a two-way impact. You know, you don't just get it one way. We've talked a bit with Rain about the impact of some of those things here, but what about in Russia? You know, the sort of broad narrative is that this sanctions package is incredibly punitive and very, very uncomfortable for Putin. What is the impact for the Russian economy of what has been done so far? And is there further to go if that was the decision?
Well, it's incredibly profound in my view. I mean, in particular, things have happened in the last week or two that generally weren't on the radar of commentators, forecasters, a couple of months ago, specifically the total closure of the central bank and its access to a large degree of its assets, which is something that's very hard for us to appreciate, because monetary policy, international currency movement seems like sort of some dark magic that happens behind the scenes. But it seems that despite the fact that Russia has spent most of the years since its invasion of Crimea in 2014 building up a war chest to make it very easy to defend its currency, thanks to the genius and determination of certain people behind the scenes. I saw, for example, the Canadian Foreign Minister, Chrystia Freeland, mentioned in this. They've identified that the way the financial system works, you can still basically make these reserves useless for the for Russians in terms of defending their currency. And what does that mean? It means that you can't support the ruble and you have a currency crisis. And this is where Putin took over with Russia, which is one of the ways you can absolutely impact the ordinary people in the Russian economy quite immediately, because Russia is effectively a massive energy exporter and importer of a lot of the other things. And that means the foreign currency situation matters. So it's going to have a really profound effect on its economy. It's going to be felt by ordinary Russians immediately through inflation. It's going to be felt by ordinary Russians through interest rates, already having doubled to 20%. Now, this doesn't mean, when people talk about crippling an economy as vast as a continent like Russia, Russia has presumably got itself into a situation where it can run its wartime economy to a functional degree, probably ad infinitum, just as, you know, it did during the Second World War, ultimately, although with more Western help than is generally acknowledged. But it means that for ordinary Russians who've been told that this is a minor military event on their borders and it will all be over soon, there's no way of hiding this from them. They will be feeling this directly. Even it seems sort of trivial, but cutting off Apple Pay and Google Pay, meaning lots of Russians not being able to use the metro, suddenly they realize that they've been reliant on lots of things. So I think it's been really quite impressive.
Thanks ever so much, Giles. A couple of specific questions have come in from people watching. I want to make sure we address. Matthew Muldoon says, we are a software as a service supplier to a named sanctioned company. Should we switch off our services to them?
I think you need to follow the official guidance from the government. So we direct you towards that. I don't want to be the sort of arbitrator of that guidance. I think you need to follow the official guidance. Of course, there's a broader question, I think, that many companies, I think all companies, are now asking: what is their exposure to Russia? What should they be doing in terms of with services they supply? And I think those are absolutely the right questions to ask. I don't think we can tell people what the resolution is, because sometimes, and I think this is something that's come up, and some of you may have seen Tony Danker put an article on LinkedIn reflecting some of the conversations he's had. Because if you're someone who's producing commodities that are either, you know, that citizens are relying on either in Russia or on other sides of the border, which are, you know, basic commodities, food, etc. What is the right thing to do, I think, can be deeply challenging. And so what we would say is look at what the official sanctions are, make sure that you are implementing those in full, and ask yourselves as an organization, you know, what is the right path for you, and what are the implications for citizens on all sides of the border, and make the right choices for you as a business?
I think probably it's the same answer to this other question from Christoph Reitemeyer, who is talking about this sort of the technicalities of an EU UK subsidiary of a Russian holding company. But I guess one of the things we would say is, if we look at the official, take a look at the official guidance, if it doesn't quite give you the specificity you need, then maybe come back to the CBI, and that's something that you can put some more clarity on.
And I think a few things on that. One of the things that, you know, and we've seen it, you know, unfortunately through all the crises that we've kind of, you know, lived through in our time, you know, or certainly in my time at the CBI, is where you have specific questions where the government guidance is unclear, then do pass that to us and to that impact. Because then we can talk to BEIS, we can talk to DIT, we can talk to the Treasury, and we are also collating from government some of the questions they have. Because obviously, you know, I was talking to one official yesterday who said they are learning very quickly about oil refining and how that works on a very practical level. So I think it's using us as that information flow on both sides, so both businesses can make the right decisions and policymakers can make the right decisions on the basis of full information.
Yeah, none of this is easy. Rain, we're going to try and do our segue into the sort of second chapter of this morning's conversation. The CBI obviously published its budget submission ahead of the spring statement next month. Something like that, when you've got a sort of stated commitment going for growth, and then this happens, do you just sort of carry on regardless? Do you adapt? Like, how do the two things relate to one another?
Well, I think it's really difficult, right? So I suppose we try and step back and think, you know, what are some of the economic impacts that we'll see in the UK, and therefore what should the Chancellor be thinking about on his mind? And I think there's a few things. One, it just puts that emphasis on funding our public services, because we, you know, there may be more support that we need to provide internationally, and therefore that, you know, that is funded from you know, from government revenues. And I think, so thinking about that, and also I think if we'll see higher inflation here in the UK, we've seen the impact of the energy price cap and what that, you know, the impact that's had on household budgets, or will do in March and April, and in 6 months' time with energy prices higher, we're going to see an even bigger squeeze on household income. So I think we have to bear in mind that the challenges the Chancellor is facing now have got more difficult. But at the same time, I think we do see our role on importantly focusing on the long-term drivers of growth and standard of living in the UK, and what businesses and policymakers can do, because, you know, take the example of the transition to a low carbon economy. The challenges from climate change have not gone away. In fact, you know, on some levels, they've got more acute. And certainly, you know, we've seen that in recent years. So we still need to make that transition. That takes a huge amount of investment. And so I think all of the things that we set out in our submission still stand, though I think it does put more emphasis on some of the short-term measures we were looking at on how do you help businesses in energy-intensive industries get through what we know is going to be a really difficult time. So some of those short-term measures become important. But I think some of the things that the Chancellor set out in his May's lecture, how do we get growth and productivity over the long term? It's about people, it's about capital and investment, and it's about ideas. And I think our proposals there still really stand. I think on investment, we know to make the transition to net zero economy, we need £50 billion of investment, both public and private, every year to make that transition. At the moment, we're seeing about £10 billion being directed into net zero technologies. The UK is at the bottom of the G7 league when it comes to business investment as a share of GDP. And next year, the super deduction comes to an end. We know from our analysis and from a survey of our members that that's been really effective at both bringing forward investment, but also creating new investment in the UK that wouldn't have happened otherwise. And so we think that beyond 2023, we need to see a permanent investment deduction so that businesses can write off 100% of a capital asset in year one, to really get investment going over the long term. And we, in our survey, we also find that that would be effective. It would lift business investment over the next 5 years by 17%. That may not sound like much, but if you take that across the whole economy, it's a huge amount of increase in business investment and would help to fund that transition to a low carbon economy. And then the second important area is thinking about, we are all living and working longer here in the UK. We need to think about how we reskill, how we train people for a very changing economy, both in terms of areas like sustainability, adapting to a more digital economy. And yet at the moment, the main way that we get investment into training in partnership with government at the moment is through the apprenticeship levy. But it's a very old-fashioned way of thinking about training. You go off-site one day a week for a period of 12 months. But when we look at the skills crises we've had over the past year, it's been about, how do we get more HGV drivers out there? How do we have those digital skills that move to sustainability? And that talks to a more modular form of training that works better for companies and for individuals. Most people want to go on a training course over a period of a few weeks while they are in work, rather than having this sort of disjunct between training and in work. And so we think a much more flexible skills challenge fund, which would be based on the current apprenticeship levy model, but much more flexible, would just be much more fit for purpose in the challenges we're facing. So I think those are just two examples of areas where we think the Chancellor could make a real difference. And I think it's important that, you know, he almost has this bifocal lens, really, you know, how does he address some of the humanitarian challenges we're facing at the moment, but also focus on how we get growth and productivity still going over the long term, because that will always be important here in the UK.
Thanks so much, Rain. I'm going to bring in Andy, if I may. Andy Wood, who's the Chief Executive of Adams Brewers in beautiful Southwold. Nice to see you, Andy. Thank you for being here. I could see you nodding along to some of the things that Rain was saying there when talking about specific elements of the package, the permanent deduction and so on. I guess my opening gambit to you is, does any of this make a difference really to businesses like yours?
Adams is a UK mid-sized business, 75, 80 million pounds turnover. We don't know where that will land as we come out of the pandemic. 500 employees based in Southwold in Suffolk, which is only a couple of hours from London, but really suffers infrastructure issues. So getting a workforce moving around East Anglia is a real challenge. Some of the things that Rain said that were quite eye-catching, we're a brewer, we're a distiller, so we have to invest in capital plant and equipment. So the super deduction is very eye-catching for us. And I think the CBI's campaign to, you know, make that 100% tax reduction for capital capital spending would be a great thing. I think the other thing is workforce training, skills development. We've got AI, we've got machine learning, we've got a sort of broader digital agenda, we've got sustainability. We look at young people here, I think we have to look at retraining the existing workforce or even elders to come back into the workforce, creating a sense of purpose for those people as well. So some means of getting that flowing is really important for a business like Adnams. We're in a very affluent part of Suffolk. 10 miles north of here is Lowestoft, which is on the UK's deprivation index. 10 miles south is Leyston, that's another one. Lots of young people there would want to come to work at Adnams, but because the nature of our business, hospitality, working in the evenings, working at weekends, there just isn't the infrastructure to move people around. So, you know, government spending in getting people moving still is important for us in this part of the world. And finally, I mean, we've committed to sustainability and you know, the long before the letters ESG entered the corporate lexicon, we've got the war in Ukraine, but climate change is a massive issue and businesses need to be encouraged to get on with this and need to get encouraged to get on with this now. Every 5 years that we leave this, the cost of dealing with it, you know, goes up. It's exponential. So really government encouraging us to get on with this is really important. Does it all make much difference? I think some of those things really do. Others make little difference at all. And Giles and I'm sure who you'll bring in, were having having a conversation before the webinar started, and Giles observed it's the same government brain that's trying to solve this issue. And I think we do need to break out of some of that thinking somehow.
Andy, thank you. I'm going to come back to Giles then. Let's go again on this eye-catching permanent investment deduction idea, Giles. Is it politically palatable? Is it affordable? Would it work? What's your take on that?
I will try to answer all of those questions. Firstly, can I say it's identifying a really important object. As Rishi Sunak's speech to the Mays lecture last week made clear, we have a problem in this country with low levels of business investment. And it's not explained wholly by us being slightly less of a manufacturing country than some of the people we compare against. We're about 4% of GDP lower, which means about £80 billion of less lower business investment. So number one, it's the right thing to be thinking about. And number two, I mean, does it work? Well, I'm always slightly cautious about anyone who thinks the tax system is the reason for everything, but you've got to do everything you can. And what I'm not here to simply go on about Rishi Sunak's speech, but he did at least identify, we tried one thing under the coalition, which was lowering the corporate tax rate to quite considerably low levels, at quite considerable expense during a time of austerity. And it didn't work. We didn't see business investment shoot up. And at the beginning of the coalition, they also got rid of capital allowances that were aimed at investment. And so Rishi Sunak acknowledged this and said, we need to be doing something about the tax system. So my third prediction is that some idea like the one that Rain has been talking about there is probably very much in the target of the Treasury. They've said we want to do something about the tax system for investment, and we know what doesn't work. This is one of the things that might. Now, I'd still be very cautious. When Andy and I were chatting before this broadcast began about the single brain, I was talking about the fact that we had Mandelson doing new industry, new jobs in 2009, then we had the plan for growth actually in 2011 with Osborne and others, lots of different sectoral examinations, then industrial strategy under Vince, then repudiation of industrial strategy under Sage, then bringing back industrial strategy under Greg, then Quasi-Quartet getting rid of the Industrial Strategy Council. Then we have Rishi Sunak and the plan for growth, which is all about investment, capital and ideas, which are basically the building blocks that every single government growth document always has. You need more capital, you need cleverer people, and you need to combine them cleverly with a big R&D budget. That has been the constant strand, and there's nothing wrong with it. It's just, as Andy observed earlier, if you're constantly doing those things, unless you're doing something starkly different in one of them, why would you expect a very different result? So I would say it's worth a try. It won't solve all of that 40 billion difference. You also need to have businesses with a really powerful reason to invest, which means big growing markets, exciting opportunities. And that's very difficult for the government to simply produce. And I think there's quite a lot missing from the government's approach. It didn't talk about the loss of our custom with the EU. I mean, being part of a really big market that can serve thousands of customers is a reason to invest. It didn't talk much about the fact that this productivity crisis hit us during a time when demand growth was really, really weak, and that we're now in a very different circumstance right now. We, for the first time in decades, we are bumping against the limits of the economy. Small business people, and I think Andy can talk with greater authority on this, but small business people looking at their energy bills, looking at their labour costs and going, I'm not sure how much more I can produce with this. We've all of us noticed the difficulties with service industries. So, but that produces an imperative to either scale up or get out. And that's the sort of thing, running the economy hot, that can sometimes inspire more productivity. And we didn't hear very much from the government about that because it's slightly awkward because of the way it turned up during those coalition austerity years. So I think a good start. The apprenticeship levy is a really difficult topic, which we can maybe discuss at another opportunity. But I think the government needs to be looking at every other cylinder too. And I don't think investments incentives at the tax side on their own are enough to get us out of this rut.
Interesting. Thanks ever so much, Giles. It's sort of a good start, but with gaps. Andy, let's pick up on some of that stuff. You run, as you say, a medium-sized company. Thinking about what there has been in place the last sort of decade or so in terms of business investment, has any of that worked? Have you seen any of it? Has it been impactful for you?
Around the margins, I think. Okay. I would say. Around the margins, You know, we in 2006, as long ago as 2006, we built a distribution warehouse outside of town, and we made it as an integrated system. Okay. And it acts like a thermoslast. No artificial heating, no artificial cooling. It takes carbon out of the atmosphere. It's built 7 meters down in a disused gravel working, so it's got thermal stability. Had we bought a normal sort of crinkly tin shed that you see by the side of the road and put air conditioning in it and heating in it and all sorts of plant and equipment, we could claim capital allowances. Because we built an integrated system, HMRC didn't know how to deal with it, and we didn't get a full range of capital allowances on it. And that's the sort of unintended consequences that happens. And I think we do need, as Giles and Rain have advocated, a more holistic overview of what's going on as we move to decarbonize the economy. Innovative solutions are going to come up that the tax system can't deal with, and we're going to need to think about that. As a mid-sized business, and I'm going to make a plea for mid-sized businesses. Often government policy is about SMEs, or it's about the very big large producers, and I'm not saying they shouldn't be a focus, but sitting in the middle is a whole army of mid-sized businesses who actually build a sense of place, stay put, employ lots of people, spend more of their money locally. I think some government policy directed towards that forgotten army would not be a bad thing.
Yeah, indeed. Giles, let's go again on this decarbonisation question. I mean, if I had a pound for every webinar I did in the lead up to and after COP, talking about decarbonisation as the number one biggest thing. The IPCC report sort of whispered in today, perhaps understandably, given the war in Europe. Has the government forgotten about going for green growth? Is it just that it's not really sexy? How do we get the momentum back? Or was there ever momentum really in the first place?
That's a great question. Can I just give a quick piece of support to what Andy just said, by the way, on the medium-sized businesses? The tax system is riddled with ideas that are great for supporting you if you're very, very small and cost billions and billions of pounds, and then kind of become less relevant or get taken away as you get big, like the low VAT threshold or the employment allowance. And these are basically ways that kind of act against growth, and it's very difficult for the government. But he's absolutely right that persistent obsession with SMEs and the very smallest companies has led to a tax system that's actually anti-growth and anti-productivity. It's a really awkward point to look at, but we need to be looking at the things that we haven't done because everything else hasn't worked. So strong support for Andy there. On the net zero thing, has it been forgotten? No, it hasn't been forgotten. And there is, in fact, I'll draw attention to the Energy Secretary Kwasi Kwarteng's tweet thread yesterday about the role of gas and how, yes, sure, we should be making the most of gas, but this is the way the market works. And we don't want to be becoming long-term reliant on gas, as an example of the way the government is trying to navigate this. However, let's not kid ourselves. This whole crisis is producing some very awkward questions for us. The urge to say, let's get some more domestic supply is more justified now than it was a few months ago. I mean, if you feel that, I don't understand quite the shape of the demand curve for gas in this country enough to know that if we had literally none of that Russian gas coming into the European market, what the price would be and how we could take it. It's an extremely awkward question. And you can understand people saying, let's be a bit more self-reliant. That's just one example of the way the net zero agenda is hurt. And another one is simply the fact that, as Rain has highlighted in her talk, it costs a lot of money to do net zero. It is a shift towards technologies that the market would not naturally support, which means it can be bad for productivity. Having the same houses that need to be sort of clad and built in all sorts of different ways is a hit to productivity. You end up with a house that might be more energy efficient, but on the whole, it's going to cost you a hell of a lot of money. These are all things that are much more difficult for a government that's in sort of fiscal difficulties and with the economy that's going to be struggling more and with higher prices and with shortages of some of the commodities that, again, Rain mentioned, which some of them are actually going to be needed in the net zero transition. So one of the points I'd make in general about Ukraine and the government's plans now, some of the crises we've had to go through in the last few years have had kind of silver linings, in the sense that, you know, the government has had a demand shock, so it's been forced to do a lot of spending, and that spending gives it a chance to think about where it's going to put its resources and help certain industries it wants to help. This is not like that. It's one of those ones where it's hitting all the things we need to be buying at the time when we're already at our limits, and it's going to force really difficult choices. And one of the most difficult choices for the government is to continue to be investing in an agenda like net zero, where the payoffs are very, very long term. So I think it's going to come under pressure, particularly as this is a hell of a year for cost of living. Cost of living is going to take a hit like you normally only see in quite a nasty recession. And I think it's a really important role for business to tell the government to keep firm.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks ever so much, Giles. Just in our last few minutes, Andy, I wonder if you might share some advice. We've got a lot of people watching this morning, many of whom will run businesses of similar sort of scale to the one that you run, even before war in Ukraine. This was a really tough time for businesses anyway, supply chain challenges, price hikes, energy, labour shortages. I mean, the package of things that people were having to deal with is pretty nasty. How are you managing to navigate some of those things? Is there sort of cool bits of advice that you could share with people, just so, you know, this was a brilliant thing for us? What would you say to people who are just looking at their long list of things and thinking, oh, my good grief, where do I go now?
I'm running a business that was closed for 280 days in 2020, closed for 220 days in 2021, and 2022 is already looking like a worst year. So I don't know I've got any cool bits of advice, but I think it's about, you know, having a very clear purpose for your business, having a very clear set of values for the business, understanding your customers better, serving your customers well. These are the thing. These are the basic building blocks of business. They stood us in really good stead throughout the pandemic. I've got to believe they're going to stand us in really good stead whilst we make our way through this very difficult time. There's all sorts of things that you can do around the margins of that, but being very clear with your employees about what the purpose of the business is and the way in which you're going to work with them to help them through this crisis is going to be really, really important. So I don't know if that's cool is or not, but it's a thing that stood us well through 2 years of pandemic and will stand us in good stead as we move through this cost of living crisis and deal with whatever is happening on the borders of Europe over in the east as that manifests itself.
Yeah, it certainly doesn't feel as though the era of difficult decisions and awkward questions is coming to an end anytime soon. Rain, I've just seen a question from Nigel Woodford that I wonder if you could have a go at. There was a lot of talk a couple of days ago about SWIFT as part of the sort of seizing up of Russian sort of financial systems. And Nigel's asked a question about cryptocurrency. Is that something that should be restricted? Because at the moment, that's still all working. I mean, heaven knows how it does work. I've no idea. But is that something that is even regulatable? Or is that on the table as part of something you could sanction? Maybe Giles knows the answer.
I'll have a go very, very briefly and maybe also come back to the sort of costs of net zero and whether we can afford it, because I think it's really important to be clear on that and what the government is doing. Look, I think around cryptocurrencies, part of the problem is they are not regulated by their nature in the same way. And obviously there are more official currencies and less official currencies. So I think what I do know is the Bank of England and financial regulators will absolutely be looking at this issue and trying to see what they can do within the realms in which they operate to ensure that there aren't loopholes in terms of the financial payments. I think Giles articulated really well how powerful it has been to freeze those central bank reserve assets and to kind of limit the war chest that Putin has built up. I think just briefly on the issues around sort of net zero, I think we do need to be really clear that You know, the OBR estimates if we had the public amount of investment we need to make the transition to net zero, that would probably add about 20% to our overall debt. That's about the same amount that we saw over the course of the pandemic. But if we don't do anything, we'd see an increase in our public debt of 100%, so five times as much by the end of this century. And to be honest, if we think about it, it's probably an underestimate of the overall cost. So I don't think we can afford not to do this. And I think even when we think about energy security, one of the challenges in the UK is actually we are heavily dependent on natural gas at the moment. And what we want to do is to move to more electricity, ground source heat pumps, air source heat pumps. So it's proven technology. And that would help to ease some of the pressures we're seeing on household energy bills if we had better energy efficiency as well. So we're encouraging the policies we need to see to deliver that, and also think about how we encourage hydrogen and some of the other newer forms. So I think it's important that we keep that investment going to make that transition as well, and it can actually help some of the pressure we're seeing on household bills if we do it right and get the right regulatory framework.
We're out of time this morning. Thank you very much for everybody for joining or listening, if wherever you are. Thank you, of course, to Andy Wood, who's Chief Executive of Adams, and to Giles Wilson, the Institute for Government, and to Rain. We'll be back next week, of course, with more on this. In the meantime, take care of yourselves. Go put the kettle on before you open your emails, and have a good day. Thanks so much. Bye.